sunyavadi paschacha de satarane omangyanam timurandasya gananjana shalakaya chaksurun militam jainam tasmai sri gurave namaha. So I'm offering my obeisances unto Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master, who so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was standing in the midst of darkest ignorance. So I'm very happy to be here tonight. This is a very special place, actually. I can feel it. The presence of where Prabhupada, this is our cradle of ISKCON here, where Prabhupada started his movement. And he seemed to offer something different to all of us. I was trying to think what it was exactly, trying to remember. Because we all had, I remember when Prabhupada was asked by a reporter, television reporter. The television reporter pointed out that we have so many churches already, why have you come? And it's a fact, you go every block there's a church. And all of us, I think, had been sufficiently exposed to religion in one form or another. But there were several things about Srila Prabhupada that made us want to join him. Another time a reporter asked him, well, what have you offered that's different? And Prabhupada said, I am not bluffing. He said, I'm telling the truth. I'm giving the real thing. So, well, what he meant was, well, let me just tell you my story. I first went to a Sunday feast in a room, something like this, actually, about this size, in Philadelphia in 1969. And at the time I went to the Krishna temple, I was in the third year of graduate studies in religion. And so I had visited the temple because, well, some people made me, more or less, like my wife. Oh, you never go anywhere, and so on. And but I had seen devotees chanting on the campus at the university I was at, and had thought there was something important, that there's some kind of shift in the world's spiritual ecology, that the missionary effort was coming this way rather than just going that way. I thought that was significant. And then a week or two later, a friend of mine says, oh, there's this far-out place, you got to come to this far-out love feast. Those days everything was far-out, or just frout. So anyway, I came, and I wasn't expecting so much. So at that time, I'd been studying religion. I went to undergraduate school on I majored in philosophy because I was looking for the truth, naively. So 4 years of philosophy, analytical linguistic analysis, logical positivism, and I realized that there was no truth. In fact, my senior year, I went around and asked various professors why they were what they were getting out of philosophy. And one person said to me that the guy who later became the department chairman said that he was in philosophy to win arguments. And the person I respected the most told me that success in philosophy is being clear about what you're confused about. But I was one of these people that really wanted the truth, and for that reason I decided eventually that I would study religion, because all these people in the philosophy department, what they had in common was they hated religion. So if I thought, if these characters all hated religion, maybe there's something to it. So I went to this religion department at Temple University. It was kind of a revolutionary department in those days, because they were going to have Islam taught by Muslims and Hinduism taught by Hindus and Buddhism taught by Buddhists. It was supposed to have this experiential dimension to it, so that was of interest. So, but 3 years later, I was not too much closer to anything. But I had come to one conclusion. I had studied all various religions because I thought, why should I be limited to the religion that I was born in or that was locally available? You could get on a plane and be in Delhi in a day or two. You know, why be so narrow? So I was going to look at all the religions of the world, not just those that were present to me by accident of birth. And so I decided that there was one thing that was true about all religions, at least on their highest level. I found at least to me what was one common thread. And that was stated very succinctly by Lord Buddha. He said that material life is suffering. This is the first of the Four Noble Truths. Material life is suffering. And I agreed with that. I had had ample experience at that point. Actually, you don't have to have a whole lot of experience. You just have to look around a little bit. And in my own case, I had a younger brother who was very close to me, just 2 years younger. And he got killed in a motorcycle accident, very young. And I realized the nature of the material world. I mean, because I realized, first of all, that when he died, I felt a great deal of grief. And then I realized, here I am feeling this grief because of one person has died. And the reason I'm feeling grief is that he happens to be related to me, which is accidental. Really, I ought to be feeling grief for every single soul that dies. And so thinking like that, I got to imagine that I got an inkling of the constant pain of the universe. How many people are dying every day? How many people are in grief all the time? What are we going around saying? Oh, this is a nice place. So I understood then that material existence is suffering, that everything is temporary. And I had the realization that to achieve anything in this world, you have to work very hard. And it was very discouraging to work hard to achieve something temporary. But if I had to work that hard to do something well, at least it should be permanent and eternal. And so I could see that because everything was temporary, that everything was going to be of the nature of suffering. So I agreed with that. Then he said that the cause of this suffering is our desires, our graspings, our cravings. So I could see that too. I had lots of desires and all my attachments to various things. We're flowing through this world like smoke. And we grab onto various things and our grasp is ripped away. And so because we have attached, we're attached to our bodies, we're attached to our relationships, we form all kinds of attachments. And because those attachments are all broken in the course of time, we suffer. So if one could be completely detached, free from living in this world, but free from all attachment whatsoever, then you would be happy. I could see that. So he said, the cause of our sufferings are desires. And he said, the cure is to become free from these desires. Great, I could understand that. But then just try it. And this was 1969. Everyone was going berserk in those days. We were all under the illusion, a big part of my generation was under the illusion that the way to salvation lay through the ingestion of certain chemicals in fairly steady or fairly large doses. So we were psychic explorers. In fact, from here, the first kind of Hare Krishna propaganda sheet devised by Prabhupada's Western disciples said, stay high forever, no more come down. Because everybody was looking for the high that was going to get you there and you never came down again. Unfortunately, all these different kinds of chemicals, things we were taking shelter of, only increased our attachment. It gave you the illusion of getting somewhere, but actually, when it was all over, you needed to score again. You needed some money to score. Somehow or other, they weren't giving it out free, like prasadam. So I was not becoming free from my material desires. And they seem to be getting worse, actually. And the people around me seem to be getting more and more entangled. So there I was. That was my situation at the time I walked into the Hare Krishna temple. So anyway, I sat down with the Sunday feast. There was a kirtan, which I got absorbed in, liked it. And then I sat down, and some devotee sat down, scowling and stern fellow. And he gave this very harsh and cutting lecture. Because in those days, the devotees were very much in the mood of, well, chastisement. In fact, they used to crowd in front of the deities during kirtan so the deities wouldn't have to look at non-devotees and have their vision spoiled. So anyway, this devotee gave a heavy lecture about following four regulative principles. And so he was kind of on our case because we weren't following them, you know. No eating meat, fish, eggs. No illicit sex. This was the, you know, the beginning of sexual liberation, and he was saying no illicit sex. No intoxication. That was a real dose of cold water, huh? It wasn't that Krishna consciousness movement had a super popular message in a way. You know, it was really against the tide. No intoxication, not even coffee, tea, cigarettes, what to speak of all the other things. And no gambling, speculative enterprises like that. So as he was speaking, I could see that all the people around me were getting turned off and disgusted. Some people actually got up and walked out with their bell-bottom pants and patchouli oils and so on, pre-Raphaelite hair and everything. But I thought, wow, somebody is telling the truth. I was really impressed because I knew this was the truth. That if you want to become liberated from the material world, you have to give up your material attachments. I had already decided that was the case. And so I was a little put off by the stern manner of the devotee, but for the first time, I thought there might be something serious about these Krishna devotees. And then he went on to say something very interesting to me. He said, you cannot give up these things simply by trying to withdraw your senses from them, just by trying to let go. Well, that I knew because I tried that. You know, lasted about 20 minutes. He said, you just can't just give things up. If you take your senses away from the objects of the senses and don't give them anything else to do, naturally, you'll be at a loss. And he gave a very simple example. It was kind of a stupid example, but it brought the point home. He said, if you have a child that's playing with a knife or something harmful, if the mother takes the knife out of the kid's hands, he screams. But if she takes one of his toys and puts it back in, then he's happy. So he said, you have to give your senses some positive engagement, some positive spiritual engagement. He said, if you do that, then your senses are connected with transcendence. And he said, so the first engagement you have to do is chant the Hare Krishna mantra. He said, you have to begin with your tongue. And so you cannot just be silent, but if you chant the Hare Krishna mantra, your tongue has permanent engagement. And that you become purified. That's a transcendental sound. It doesn't originate from this material world. And if you chant it, you'll become purified and your material desires will begin to go away. Well, this was a new idea of me, transcendental sound and transcendental objects of the senses and so on. I never really thought that there was such a thing. But anyway, it sounded reasonable. You know, I didn't know if it was true or not, but at least it sounded that at least it was reasonable. I thought in those days if something is reasonable, then it might be true. I guess there are reasonable things that were false, but I was a philosophy major, remember. So I got some beads. I purchased a set of Japa beads, and I went home and I started chanting. This seemed to be to test it out. Here the guy was making a claim that you could test. So I started to chant. And I just sat down, and I don't know how many rounds I chanted, maybe three or four rounds. I'd sit down and kind of close my eyes and concentrate on the Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Try to do it really well and concentrate, and I did that every day. And a week went by or so, and my material desires began to go away. I mean, I didn't experience, you know, hallucinations and, you know, the kind of purple and green things moving like this and all that, but like lust and greed and anger began to go away. And so I kept on chanting, and they still started to go away. Well, then I was at a real loss. I didn't know what to do with myself. All I knew I could do was chanting. And sort of many of the things I'd been engaged in, I was no longer very much attracted to. And what was I going to do? And that was one problem. And the other problem was this Hare Krishna mantra was very powerful. But I really didn't know what it was or who these people were. But if I knew, I had the sensation if I kept on chanting, something was going to pick me up and do something to me. And I wasn't quite sure who or what it was. And did I really wanted it to be done? Because I wanted to become free from material desires, but then faced with the imminent prospect of doing so, I was kind of, well, maybe not. I remember reading, when I read the Confessions of St. Augustine earlier, he had talked about a time where he was not quite sincere when he prayed. He said, "Lord, give me chastity, but not just yet." But mostly I was scared. I didn't know what it was and who these people were and what I was getting myself into. So I quit chanting. And I guess a week went by or so, and I wasn't chanting, and I started to feel really horrible. And then it was like this big, greasy cloud rolled back over my consciousness, and I began to feel scuzzy and unwashed all the time. And I remember reading in Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield talk about his roommate who didn't brush his teeth, how he had mossy teeth, and I felt like I had mossy teeth, you know. I mean, I just felt grungy all over and inside, you know, deep inside, and my material desires had come back with a vengeance. And so I thought, well, I'll start chanting again, but I'm going to be a little skeptical and check out who these people are, you know. So I started to go back to the temple, and the next step was to get some literature. Now, the devotees didn't have a lot of books in those days. Wasn't like now, so it was. But I managed to get a copy of Prabhupada's commentary on the Isha Upanishad, it was incompetently produced book. You know, it had a kind of weird cover, and the typography. There was a number of typos, and there was lots of capital letters when they didn't need capital letters, and things like that. It was not well edited book, and the language was very simple. Now, I was a person that was used to a certain amount of sophistication, you know. But I kind of got past all that, and I read it in this simple English, and it only took a few pages to realize that I was in the presence of something that was bigger and better than me. You know, any of the kind of cultural condescension I had was gone. Because although Prabhupada was speaking in very simple English, what he was saying was very heavy. And I began to read with a great deal of fascination. And when I finished reading once, I started over again and read a second time. I wanted to make sure. And one thing is, I had studied the Isha Upanishad. It was just one of those books that, you know, just grab you and pick you up and don't let you down again. And like almost every sentence is saying something important to you. And I was a changed person, I think, when I finished reading that book. I had studied the Isha Upanishad in one of my Hinduism courses. And it was very mysterious. That is to say, nobody understood what it meant. Even the translator had a remark about how obscure the verses were. And my teacher, who taught it, didn't know what it meant either. And we sort of convinced ourselves that not knowing what it meant was part of the experience, you know, of being mystified. Like, for example, Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate. It begins like that. Huh? Well, my scholarly translation said, Om, this is full, that is full. When the fullness is taken from fullness, fullness remains, like that. Well, what does that mean? This is full, that is full. Well, Prabhupada's translation was like this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is perfect and complete. And because he is completely perfect, all emanations from himself, such as this material world, are also completely equipped as complete wholes. Well, all of a sudden, that made sense. It was like somebody took something that was really blurry, you know, and turned the focus, so it came into sharp focus. But then I wondered, here's the word Om, and Prabhupada says in the word for word, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Well, what business does he have saying, you know? But then in his commentary, he explains why he is translating Om in this way. And Idam, Om Purnam, Idam Purnam, Om Purnam, Adapurnam Idam, you know, this is full, that is full. This means transcendence, that means the material world, and so on. So he explains like that. So it's very, very clear. So I realized that here was something else again. Now, I was in training to be a professional theologian. My field was philosophy of religion and philosophical theology. You know, I was trained in a very rigorous school of thinking. And that's when I began to start to rethink everything I ever thought I knew about transcendence, about the material world, and so on. So all this came through Krishna consciousness, and I found myself becoming a devotee. The first thing I'd ever thought when I saw the devotees jumping up and down and chanting was, you'll never catch me doing that. But, you know, I never thought that I would have found such a profound philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Yeah, because I was a snob. I was an academic person. And people who do the equivalent of stand in the street corners and bang tambourines are not supposed to have sophisticated theologies. They're supposed to be kind of stupid, enthusiastic persons, you know, where these high church Episcopalians and people who don't jump up and down, they're the ones that think. All those kind of stereotypes were just blown aside by the Krishna consciousness movement, and I found myself becoming a devotee, much to my surprise and also much to the shock of the religion department when I walked in one day like this.